The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayabhataka Swami on September 10th, 1990 in Copenhagen. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 14, Verse 30.
Kakaroti vachalang pangulangayate giringat kripa tamahang bande si gurung dinatarinang paramananda madhavam si chaitanya iswaram. Everyone knows English, or you have it? My dear Vidura, all good fortune unto you. The foolish king, who thought himself very learned, thus insulted the great sages, and the sages, being broken-hearted by the king's words, became very angry at him. Text 31. Hanyatam hanyatam esha papa prakriti dharuna jivan jagat asavasu kurute basma sadhruvam. Translation. All the great saintly sages immediately cried, "Kill him, kill him. He is the most dreadful, sinful person. If he lives, he will certainly turn the whole world into ashes in no time." Purport. Saintly persons are generally very kind to all kinds of living entities, but they are not unhappy when a serpent or a scorpion is killed. It is not good for saintly persons to kill, but they are encouraged to kill demons, who are exactly like serpents and scorpions. Therefore, all the saintly sages decided to kill King Vena, who was so dreadful and dangerous to all human society. We can appreciate the extent to which the saintly sages actually control the king. If the king or government becomes demoniac, it is the duty of a saintly person to upset the government and replace it with deserving persons who follow the orders and instructions of saintly persons. So in the Vedic time, thus end the Bhaktivedanta Swami translation purport to text 30 and 31, chapter 14, canto 4 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the matter of the story of King Vena. In the Vedic age, which is not very well documented in the Western world for unknown reason, so much attention has been given to Babylonian, Egyptian, the pharaohs. But the Vedic civilization is by and large a mystery here in the Western world, to some degree possibly misrepresented. Although it predates all these other Mediterranean and Middle East civilizations, and it has a much more profound civilization. At that time, the king was an institution, and he had particular specific duties. The constitution was already given in the codes of Manu, or the scriptures. And the king was to enforce the law that people were following the proper codes of behavior. He was to have a police and an army and defend the kingdom. He was also to apprehend the miscreants, the criminals, the robbers, arrest them and punish them. So he was considered the arm. Just like in a body we have arms. Arms are specifically for defending. But the sages, the brahmanas, were considered the head. They were to guide the rest of the body. So earlier in this chapter, it explains in a previous chapter how this King Vena, even as a child, he was a very cruel person. When he would play with his neighborhood kids, he would murder a few of them. Just in playing, he'd strangle them and then they'd die. As he was a child, no one could do anything. At, 5 years of age, he'd be killing his friends. He was a really heavy character. So when he grew up, he was worse. He was a real despot. So all the sages have come to him and they requested that as a king, you're to protect the citizens. You're to establish and follow the principles of religion. You should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You should follow, giving him so many good instructions. So there are also verses in the Vedas that say that a properly situated king is representing the devas, the demigods, representing God on earth, things like that. So he took those and said, what do you mean worship God? What do you mean worship? You're so into worshiping the demigods. I am the embodiment of God. I am the embodiment. He just twisted everything around. He's supposed to represent the idea being that God is protecting everyone so that the king properly is protecting the citizens and he's also representing God. Not that he's God. But he twisted it and said, you should worship me. Bring your aarti tray, bring your lamps, bring your offering, you do puja to me. Why do you want to worship anyone more than me? There's no one superior to me. Something like that. So when the sages heard this, they saw this person's a cruel, he's a rascal, and on top of that, he thinks he's God. So that finally, when they heard this, then they decided he should be killed. If he's allowed to live as the king, then he's going to just completely burn the whole world to ashes. He's going to create a lot of problems for everybody. So at that time, the king had the council of brahmanas. They were like ministers, but they weren't below the king, they were above the king. The king was supposed to offer them respect and take their guidance, and according to their guidance, he was supposed to govern. He had a subordinate council of departmental head ministers, but this was a special council of Brahmins or sages. So he didn't care for them. He said, you worship me, why are you worshiping God? So they were so powerful that by mystic power, they could force the king to leave his body. Just by their own, they didn't have to take a gun out and shoot him or anything. Simply by mantra, they could make the king leave his body. The king didn't realize how powerful they were. Of course, today, such type of wise men and powerful wise men are not readily visible. Certainly, they don't have that power to curse. Hardly anyone has the power to bless. Srila Prabhupada wanted, however, that there should be some qualified Krishna conscious people who would be able to guide governments. Someone who is a sage or someone who is a brahmana. He doesn't want to personally manage the government. It's not like they want to kill the king, then take over and run the government themselves. They want to remain above, because being a king or being a politician is not a clean job in one sense. It's a little bit of a dirty work. So someone who wants to remain on a very transcendental position, on a very spiritualized position, if he goes into that particular work, then it's easy to get polluted. So they either have someone who's a warrior, who's a courageous, all right, he likes to have a little luxurious life, that doesn't matter, if he does his job. And if he listens to the wise guidance. So the wise men, they didn't want to become the government. Rather, they wanted to have a powerful warrior who would take their good advice and implement it. They wanted a leader personality, but the leader should also follow the higher intelligence. So this King Venu was such a rascal. He didn't follow anybody. And he was a very cruel person. So they saw that we had to get rid of him. Otherwise, there won't be any peace in the world with this type of person ruling. So Srila Prabhupada wanted that we should have Krishna conscious governments. The people should become spiritualized. Their consciousness should be uplifted. They should know the higher principles of life. What is the progressive advancement of human civilization? Those who are in the parliament or those who are actually guiding government, making law, they should all be following the modes of goodness. They should be not sinful people, but they should be rather very pure people. The reality is something different, but this is the actual ideal situation. This is how the laws were handed down, of course, originally by God. Those were, you can say, interpreted or applied to the present time by the Council of Brahmins. And the king was the one who would implement the laws. So It was working very well until the brahmanas became contaminated. They became polluted also. Then the king, here, there's a kshatriya polluted, but the brahmanas were pure. So that could be adjusted. But if the brahmanas are spoiled, then where is the hope? So this is a problem in developed later on. He said the whole Varnashram system gradually became distorted. However, there's even 2,500 years ago in India, there was one great king named Chandragupta. And this was just maybe 2,300 years, just after the, and I can't remember whether it's after the Buddhist rule or before, I think it's after. He was guided by a Brahmin called Kautilya, who also saw that the present king was a kind of a despot. So he wanted to put in this Chandragupta. He saw was a very good person. So he gave him advice how he could throw over the government and take over himself. So this Chandragupta followed his advice and he became the emperor. And he was such a powerful emperor that he conquered and united all of the princely states in India at that time. In fact, his kingdom spread from Persia to Indochina borders. So he was very powerful. Now, his Brahmin guide, Kautilya or Chanakya, he offered that you be my prime minister and I'll give you a palace, I'll give you, he said, I'll be your prime minister for the purpose of serving the people. But I don't want any salary, I don't want any perks, I don't want any house. I won't live in your palace. I'll live in a grass hut. Outside the palace grounds, you can give me some garden somewhere. I'll build my grass hut and I want to live there. Because if I accept your salary, I become your paid man. Then I'll lose my intellectual independence. So I don't need anything. I'm a saintly person. I can live with a few cloths and something to eat. I don't need luxury. If I live in your luxurious house, then I may develop a desire, a taste for all luxury and become dependent on those things. I want to live in a simple way. I'll give you my knowledge. I'll give you my service. I don't need any salary from you. So, this is a very rare kind of person. He lived by a much higher principle of goodness. So that was the principle, just as example. That was the principle the Brahmins would live. Even 500 years ago, during the time of Lord Chaitanya, the brahmanas followed this principle of a simple lifestyle. The kings would have big palaces and big houses, the landlords. But the brahmanas, they would live simply. They'd live in mud houses. Nowadays, when you see pictures of India with people with mud houses in Denmark, then people think that, oh, this is very poor people, this is really bad. Of course, nowadays people are studying alternative technology, and they're finding that one of the best substances for building a house is mud. Because it's a very good insulator. If you have a thick mud wall, that's a good insulation in the hot weather. You're in India, you have more problem with heat than cold. So that thick wall keeps out the heat, and it's very cool inside. A grass roof is a better insulation than a concrete house. Concrete absorbs the heat, bricks absorb the heat and become very hot, unless you have a very thick brick wall. So the mud is a good insulator, the grass is a good insulator. I know one millionaire, he has... he lives only in grass and mud house. Of course, he put air conditioner inside. But he likes the aesthetic. But we get the idea that this is very primitive, but it's also very practical. And even a common man, he can have a house. So it's not necessarily progress. Everybody has a brick house. If you live in a cold climate, you need to have brick houses, you need to have double windows, you need to have so many facilities to survive against the climate. But if you're living in an environment which is different, then you have also indigenous kind of technologies which have developed. That doesn't mean it's primitive, it may also be practical. We have in our Gurukul in Mayapur, we have all the boys are staying in these mud and grass houses with a very high roof. So they find even without fans, without air conditioning, without any anything, because of the very nature of the house and putting them in between many trees and like a forest, that it's very cool, it's very pleasant, and the vibration is very aesthetic. The headmaster of the Gurukul school, He said, I don't want any brick buildings for the students, because when the kids start to play and talk, the echoes in the brick, and it makes so much sound, and then it creates a passionate vibration. But here in the grass and the mud and the trees and the bushes, it absorbs all the sounds and it keeps it very peaceful. In spite of having so many kids, it's still peaceful. Otherwise, you get that many kids together, it's a racket. But here, even though so many kids, it's peaceful. So this also keeps the children peaceful, keeps them serene. So he has a whole philosophy behind. So many things affect us. We don't realize it. But according to the environment we live in, this has a effect upon our own consciousness. In fact, even the people we meet, their vibration, their attitudes, that rubs off on us. Prahlad Maharaj said that just like a mirror, association is so powerful that our own consciousness will mirror the people we're with. If we're with people that are very negative, they're frustrated, they're bitter, it's easy for us to also develop a bitter, negative attitude. If you associate with people who are always taking intoxication, it's hard to resist the urge to also join them and take intoxication. So association is a very powerful thing. So although we are individuals, we're independent, we have free will, but what happens is that according to the association we choose, we gradually sacrifice that real independence. We may think we're independent, but because we're only offered multiple choices, so to speak. Because whatever association we're in, a certain number of choices are going to be given. Like some friends say, let's do this or that. He's not going to say so many things. He'll only usually say a certain limited number of ideas. Let's go to the movie, let's go to the races, let's go to the beach, let's go to the tavern, let's go to the disco, whatever. So depending on the association, you get different choices. You get different kind of environment. So what happens is that we actually, by our association, we get conditioned in a particular way. So therefore, if one wants to advance in spiritual life, it's recommended one should associate with spiritual people. Just like people who want to advance in business, they join the Rotary, they join the commercial chambers of commerce to get association with other business people, to get ideas. They may subscribe to the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or some similar newspapers to get the ideas from the other business people. So if somebody wants spiritual life, then we have to also choose that type of association. Associate with the devotees of Krishna. Associate with people who are regularly practicing yoga, who are taking a spiritual lifestyle as their way of life. Read literatures which are giving us spiritual knowledge. These things are the natural effects or natural environment which will be beneficial for our advancing in spiritual life. General people follow the leader. You see, nowadays people don't follow the leader as much, but still people follow certain social leaders. Here in this verse, this King Venu, he was supposed to be the leader of society, so the wise men could see that if he's a leader and people follow him, the whole society is going to become a hell. So they wanted to replace him for a proper leader. It's a very unique situation. There's very few examples of this in the Vedas where they had to remove a king like that. Generally, the king would listen to the Brahmins. He would change his ways. He would respect the Brahmanas. This king was so belligerent, he didn't care for anybody. He thought he was independent of all natural laws. So we have to avoid also developing this kind of belligerent attitude where we think that we're independent of all laws. We may have a free choice. That doesn't mean we don't have to take the result for whatever we do. We have a free will. If we want to kill someone, we have to take the result of that. We may also be killed in the future. You know, you try to figure out why is it that in the Middle East so many people are facing each other with weapons, why it looks like a very big war could break out any moment. And from one point of view, it's very amazing. A few months ago there was nothing, and now all of a sudden there's a big crisis. But all these people, all these countries are very active in slaughtering animals and eating animal flesh. I think, and I forget the figure, but in America there's something like, not millions, but billions of animals are killed every week or something like that. It's an incredible amount. So if you add up all the chickens, all the lambs, all the pigs, and all the cows, the amount of animals which are killed is like some mind-boggling. So who takes all that karma for killing all those innocent animals, where especially in the modern day you don't need? America has a surplus grain. In fact, they feed the grain to the animals. It says that they could feed 5 times as many people if they fed the grain directly to people rather than all fattening all the animals. In other words, you could feed off the whole population of the world a few times over instead of if you fed the grains to the people rather than feeding them to the animals. Because when you feed grain to the animal, it's producing body heat, fur, hair, bones, and so fat, and so many other things. The actual percentage that actually goes to producing muscle or flesh for eating is a very small percent. It's running around, it's expending most of that energy. But what the grain itself is already directly, we can also eat that grain and directly get the benefit. We don't have to cycle it through an animal and then kill the animal who doesn't want to die. So because people tend to be think, or they're just ignorant of the results for what they're doing, so they had to suffer in any case these laws of nature. The wise people are not trying to just put their ideas on the king. But what they are doing is they knew the laws of nature. They knew what a person should do in order to be happy. And they were giving that advice. But if the king didn't want to follow, then he was told them, you're going to suffer from your own reactions. So similarly, the Vedas are giving us knowledge. This knowledge we're presenting to everyone, whether a person wants to be a member of our society, whether they want to be a friend of our society or an associate, whether they like to live in a temple or whether they like to practice in their home or whether they just like to visit and know about what we're doing. We're giving these books to any and everyone, whether they're Christian, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Buddhist, whether they're atheist, we don't care. It's a knowledge for everyone. It's an open secret if someone wants to know it. But in their wisdom, in this knowledge, you can find out what are the natural laws which are affecting every one of us. So what's happening is that a lot of murder is going on, a lot of killing is going on in the world, killing of innocent animals. So the reaction is that without apparent reason, without a very good reason, just for some political reason, for some economic reason. You see, every country has a right to protect its own country. But here we're protecting other countries. That may be alright, but then there's not even any kind of agreement like that. In any case, whatever it is, the fact is that if innocent people die, what appear to be innocent people, it's not because they're innocent. It's because they're getting karma from previous births, Somebody has to take the karma for killing all the animals. So like this, people are dying. More people die in car accidents than who died in the whole Second World War. And car accidents are very violent, horrible things, where people get thrown out of windows and crushed by other vehicles. And wars are very horrible things. And these wars are also going on. So, if we want to have a peaceful world, we need to know the laws of nature. What Krishna consciousness is giving to the world is a way to organize things that people can be peaceful, they can be happy, there can be progressive spiritual advancement. And eventually, people will see that actually what we are presenting is not simply some religious dogma, but we are actually presenting a way of life which will solve the problems. Where people are worried about ecology, but it's just a hobby to discuss it. In practice, how many people are willing to live a simpler way of life? Unless a person becomes more spiritualized, like these brahmanas, where they actually see that the spiritual development is the goal of life, they're not going to be willing to sacrifice very much their living lifestyle. If a person thinks that the satisfaction of life means to have a lot of material comforts, that's the only happiness in life, and why will they sacrifice the real happiness of life if they have it? But if someone realizes that happiness of life comes from inner peace, from inner spiritual development, from spiritual bliss, from spiritual development of transcendental knowledge, then they can sacrifice a little bit of material facility if that will be conducive for their spiritual life. So the devotees, they rise early in the morning. Many people like to sleep late. But we find that for meditation, if we rise early in the morning before sunrise, this is conducive to our meditation. Like this, so we voluntarily take a little bit of what would be materially considered as an austerity. or an inconvenience. And the devotees learn to find that this is actually very nice because of developing a spiritual taste. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was presenting also this type of spiritual way of life. And even amongst this, we're so far from Brahminical culture that even Brahminical culture looks really good now. But from Lord Chaitanya's point of view, even amongst the Brahminical culture or the culture in the mode of goodness, he wanted people to come up to the transcendental culture. We may have to also go in a phased way, first Brahminical, then transcendental, or we can directly take people to transcendental. Transcendental includes the Brahminical automatically. But the transcendental means more than just living a life which is in harmony with nature, but to lead a life which is in harmony with God. There's a slight difference. Leading a life which is in harmony with Krishna brings out our own spiritual potential. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was very strict. He was a brahmana, he was a sannyasi. One king wanted to meet him, King Prataparudra. So the king sent a message that, "I want to meet you," but Lord Chaitanya refused. He said that, "I'm in the renounced order of life. A king is someone who's active in politics and in material enjoyment. So I don't want to meet a king because that may contaminate me. People, what will they say? My reputation will be destroyed as a spiritualist if I hobnob with the kings. I think I become a politician." So he refused to see the king. Quite a rare circumstance. The society then was still very rigid. So the king, he tried in many ways to see Lord Chaitanya, but every time he was rebuffed. Of course, part of the problem was he wanted to go see him as a king. So then finally Lord Chaitanya, he saw that this king of Orissa, he was a very great devotee. And he would go every year at the Rath Yatra festival of Jagannath, and he would sweep the road before Lord Jagannath. The sweeping of the road before Jagannath is something which is going on since thousands of years. I think there's no parallel of that. Usually the kings, you know, they're not going to sweep a road. King is not going to go out and clean the garbage from the street. But in Orissa, the king would do that. Not for any ordinary reason, but he would do it before the deity of Krishna. That when Krishna was going on a procession, he would sweep the road before Krishna just to like clean the path, that you're going on my kingdom that I'm managing on your behalf, to show that I'm the servant of Krishna, he would sweep the road. This famous story about one of the, I think the original, King Indradumna, after establishing the Jagannath worship, maybe one of his descendants, now I can't remember, I think Indradumna himself, there was a proposal that he should marry some princess from a neighboring kingdom. But that king, he sent over some spies to go check out this king, whether what type of person he is, whether he's suitable to marry my daughter. So they sent their spies. They just happened to go at the time of the Jagannath Krishna Rath Yatra festival, where they take Krishna in the procession. So there they saw that, and he came in a big procession on his elephant. Even today, he's still called Gajapati, Lord of the King of the Elephants, or Lord of King with having so many elephants. He was a very big king. In fact, during the whole Mohammedan and British rule, only Orissa resisted their occupation to the last. So he'd come up in this Jai Gornitaki Jai. He'd come up in their procession, and then he'd get down, and with a golden broom, he'd sweep the road in front of Krishna. You've all seen these big Rath Yatra cars. Everyone knows Rath Yatra, I think. The chariots about 20 meters high that go 2-3 kilometers from the Jagannath Puri temple in Orissa, India, to another smaller temple called Gundicha. So when this spy saw this, he said, "What type of king is this? He's sweeping the road. He's a street sweeper. Garbage cleaner." He went back and reported this to the king. He sent a message that, "My daughter is not going to marry any street sweeper. Forget it." So the king took that as an offense, not to him, but to the whole culture, that it's not a street sweeper if you sweep the road before God, before Krishna. This insult to Krishna's position. that a king should bow down and be subservient to the laws of Krishna, the laws of God. So he declared war against that king. And they marched off with all their, took the blessing from Jagannath and Baladev and Subhadra, and then they went off with the army, with that religious war, to defend the principle of that he was challenging. Not that he really cared for the getting this princess so much, but it was for the principle. So, on the way, the king was really praying to Krishna whether I have your blessing for this or not, whether I'll be successful. So then, in front of the king there was two young princes who were riding. One was very dark in complexion, one was very light in complexion, one was riding on a gray horse, and the other was riding on a black horse. So they're going ahead, and then they happen to meet one village lady who was carrying a big pot of yogurt. So they asked, please give us a yogurt. She said, well, I'm a poor lady. If I give you the yogurt, how will I exist? This is my income. This is my subsistence to sell the yogurt. They said, well, we are the generals for the great king Indradumna, who is coming behind us. So you give us the yogurt, and when you see him, then you ask him and he'll pay you. And she said, how is he? I can see a great king. I'm just a simple village woman. He won't allow anyone, won't speak to me. I won't get close to him. So they said, no, okay, you take this ring and you just show him this ring, and then he'll give you the payment for the yogurt. So it's a nice gold ring. So she took the ring and said, okay, I'll give the ring to him. The ring was worth more even than the yogurt. Anyway, she was a very honest person, so she was going to give the king the ring. And then these two generals drove off, took the yogurt. So then when the huge army came and she tried to see the king, the people, you know, the sentries, they stopped, what do you want? And she's making it, no, no, I had, you know, there was like a whole commotion going on the sides. So and the king, what's going on over there? See there, this woman is screaming, no, I have to see the king. And then, no, what's going on? Get out of here. I have this, you know. So then he starts, okay, bring this lady. What's the matter? And she explained what happened. Two of your generals, they came ahead. They took yogurt from me. They gave me this ring. And they told me that, you know, you'd pay for the yogurt. And he said, two of my generals? I didn't send any generals. Let me see that ring. And he looked at the ring and said, Jai Jagannath! This is Lord Jagannath's ring. What do these two generals look like? He said, one, he was a dark colored, he had a helmet with a peacock on it, and the other was a white, and he was, you know, with a, this Krishna and Balaram, you know, that he had. They just had a huge, you know, festival right there. They, you know, this was the sign that Krishna and Balaram were with them,
giving their blessings.
So, of course, they were victorious, and the other king could understand later the actual significance. So like that, Lord Chaitanya, he saw the same king, you know, and a descendant after thousands of years sweeping the road. So then he thought, well, he's not an ordinary king, he's a devotee. So then he allowed his son to come and meet him and gave blessings to his son. And then later, when he was in the garden, after the Rath Yatra, the king was advised, you don't go as a king. You dress as a Vaishnava, you wear ordinary white clothes and tilak. You just go as a humble devotee. Don't go with your helmets and your soldiers and your ministers and all that. He's not going to see you like that. If you go as a humble devotee. So then Lord Chaitanya, he was just resting in the garden, and the king came and started, King Prataparudra, massaging his lotus feet, started to sing bhajans to Krishna. He's a very good devotee, so he knew a lot of bhajans to Krishna. He was just singing, and Lord Chaitanya, he was playing that he didn't know who was doing this, and he just there relaxing and listening to the bhajans. And this way, when bhajans are very nice, he really gave his blessing to this Prataparudra. So Lord Chaitanya said that in this age, if someone wants to approach him, he should do it very humbly. It's not that we go to Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that, okay, I'm a PhD, I'm a MA, or I'm a MD, or I'm a big lawyer, or I'm a big businessman, or I'm a big this, or I'm a big that, I have so many qualifications, therefore I'm going. We just go humbly, that you're all merciful, we're coming to you because we want your mercy. We don't go with any kind of material assumption of our greatness. Those things are temporary. We can use those in Krishna's service. Not that we had to ignore or, not utilize those. Whatever capacity we use it. We don't take that as some qualification for approaching Krishna. Because what he's giving us is something which these things are not really, they're not comparable or important in that sense. There are things that we can use in Krishna's service. Whatever ability we have, we use that. But when we approach the Lord, we just approach it as a simple, humble devotee. So Lord Chaitanya, he would accept anyone if they came in that way. But if they came in a very assuming way, they would often be rebuffed. Not only kings, but even pundits. If the pundit was very proud and he was not respectful to the previous gurus, then Lord Chaitanya also would not consider them very significant. In fact, sometimes he would criticize that you're not following your previous masters, therefore you're being unfaithful. You're being like a prostitute who's going from one person to the next. You're not being faithful to your own gurus. So Lord Chaitanya, he was strict about these principles. At the same time, anybody came unassumingly to him, wanting to get his mercy, he would give them mercy very easily. So there may be in the future times when the Krishna conscious movement will also have to advise people regarding what is the proper thing to do, what's improper to do in terms of running even countries. In order to do that, or even to advise the present people, that's why we have so many books. These books give a different perspective of life, a perspective which will give a practical understanding of how to apply spiritual life. That human beings are not just sophisticated animals, but they are living entities with a higher intelligence to be able to understand what is the purpose of life. If we don't develop that intelligence and try to understand who we are, if we don't develop our intelligence to achieve self-realization, then we remain an undeveloped human being. And the present society is basically leading people to that. Goalless civilization, not taking the people to self-realization. We should realize who we are. What were we before we took birth? What will we be after we take birth? Who are we? How do we fit into the whole universe? Who is Krishna? Who is the Supreme Lord? What is our relationship? What is this material world? What is the spiritual world? All these questions can be understood by a human being. But if we don't try to understand these and we don't approach the proper authority, then we'll be remaining in the darkness of ignorance. So all these questions can only be really understood by studying, by reading, by taking the information from these Vedas, from these Vedic literatures. Because Vedic literatures have this information in an uncontaminated way. Scientists are never going to get a clear picture how things began. You see, even the materialistic people, the materialistic thinkers before, they could understand that obviously the material nature has intelligence behind it because it's so well organized. Order is always a symptom of intelligence. You come into a city, you see there's street lights, you see there's a garbage cleanup, a road cleanup, water, all these amenities, you see there's street lights. Someone doesn't have to tell you, no, there's a government here because there's an organization. That means that some government is there. Some intelligence has been put in, otherwise these things are not running, unless there's some organization or some intelligence behind it. You see the whole nature, everything is working very nicely, so this shows that there's some intelligence. Even the atheists in the previous time, they could understand there was some intelligence, but what they thought, the atheistic people, that this doesn't prove God. Because it could be that different higher entities at different times in the universe, they had created some order, to things. They weren't God, but they were some higher entity who created some order, then left it, and someone else may have again come in and created another, some little order some other time. They had this idea, where you get a pantheistic idea that there may be many gods, or there may be many authority, but there's not necessarily any supreme authority. In the past, even atheistic people understood there was a higher intelligence. Today, still, scientists are trying to push on us that everything is by accident, which is completely ridiculous. No one's seen anything by accident just take some kind of organized form like that. Our scientist, Adaputta Das, he's calculated by using the information mathematical system. What are the odds of even creating one simple molecule of organic molecule, what to speak of, you know, creating a, you know, a whole organized living entity. Just one simple like DNA or some others, I forget what kind, one simple kind of molecule, which is a necessary building block for life. And the figure is so ridiculous that even the wildest, it is completely impossible that by sheer chance life has come. What to speak of this whole developed species according to like Darwin's theory that have developed. You're never going to prove, however, that there's existence of God or not. That you can't prove. Because even if you could finally come to the point there's intelligence, well, some higher planet, some intelligence came organized here. That doesn't prove there's a God. Of course, you can say, where did that intelligence come? Where did that come? Like this, but still it doesn't prove definitively what the origin is. So actually to understand what is our origin. So just like if we want to know who is our father, we go to the mother. We ask the mother, who's our father? You see, nowadays in society, before, you know that mother's husband was father, but maybe nowadays you don't know. Maybe the mother's not also married. So many scenarios are there. So if you really want to know who the father is, you have to go to the mother. If anyone knows, she should know. If she doesn't know, you're in real trouble. But generally, you say the mother should know. So in the same way, we want to know where our origin comes from. We have to go something which is before the origin. So these Vedas are considered like the mother. They're the information which tells us about those things which are not normally available to our perception. There are highly scientific literatures which are giving us knowledge about the self, knowledge about spiritual energy, knowledge about self-realization, knowledge about Krishna, about creation, about everything. So distributing these books, these transcendental literatures, is actually giving kind of a revolutionary knowledge to society. In the West, they never had access to this. In fact, even in India, only these Brahmana priests would get these literatures. Before, the ancient system was like that. And generally, people weren't so educated to comprehend all these concepts. No, people, everyone is getting a good education, everyone is very literate. So there's no reason why they can't try to understand. Whether they believe or not, or whether they want to practice, at least they could understand what is the idea given in the Vedic culture. If someone doesn't know that idea, then something's missing from their life. Such a major part of the history of the world, as millions of people are practicing and finding great peace of mind, great spiritual inspiration. So why shouldn't everybody also at least know what it is? From an objective viewpoint, that we're reading so many novels and seeing so many movies, which no one can claim, no one even tries to claim that this is going to change the destiny of the world. But we are claiming, where our bold assertion is that these Bhagavatams can change the entire future of the world. Whether you believe or not, the only way you'll know, read them and find out. So those devotees who are giving these literatures, they're giving this kind of new perspective on life, a whole new cultural input into society which was never there before. So you're all very dear to the Lord for doing this a confidential service, and we hope that everyone will take advantage of distributing these books or reading the books of the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and thus your life will be sublime. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Any question?
Do one have to see God to believe in Him?
You don't have to see Him like that with the eyes in order to believe in God. One could believe due to many reasons presented. One can also experience God even without seeing. Say somebody, they eat something with their eyes closed. They don't see the food, but they can taste it, they can smell it, they can feel the effect of the food. So they'll believe that there's food even without seeing. So you can also, by hearing God, you can believe Him. It's said that more important than seeing is hearing. When we are asleep at night, our seeing is not working. But the ears are always working. When people want to wake up, they set alarm clock. The alarm clock makes a sound. The sound, because the ears are the one sense that doesn't ever completely turn off. Even people can sleep in a room with the lights on sometimes if they're tired enough, right? But if it's a very noisy place, you can hardly sleep. The ears are, in any case, the ears are the most sensitive, they're the most spiritually attuned. So it said first we should realize God, we should try to see God through our ears. Hear about Him, chant His name. By chanting the mantra, which is not different from God, and you can also feel a change in your own consciousness. You can feel the effect in your own self. And that is even more important than seeing. Seeing also, but not, we don't want to just see God in a sense of, what is sight? Sight is the reflection of light waves coming off of different objects. We want to see in a more complete, fourth dimensional spiritual sense. A spiritual type of realization, which is not simply a superficial vision, but a deep realization where we can see our own spiritual identity and we can also see the Lord's on a higher plane. So to bring our consciousness up to that level, to be able to have that profound realization, we need to purify the consciousness. And the easiest and recommended way is through hearing. Hearing these classes on the Srimad Bhagavatam, and also chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, and hearing the vibration. So that hearing, then you can actually experience the presence of Krishna. You can experience that sublime feeling. Just like after eating a meal, you'll feel full, you'll feel satisfied, you'll feel peaceful.
Spirit is colorful?
Yes, it's filled with variety and color and quality because spirit is the origin of matter. So matter has so much color and variety, so spirit is also filled with color and variety. But this is temporary. Now it's a fall, just end of summer. Very soon the leaves will turn red and yellow and fall off and it'll become winter. So these are temporary manifestations. But the spirit is eternal. So its variety, its color is eternal. It doesn't die or cease to exist.
What about burning out from?
This is a partial manifestation. The formless is expanded everywhere, but the formless is dependent upon the form of God with form. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahmano Pratishtaham, I am the basis for the impersonal light which is expanded everywhere. It's true that there's an impersonal light, but just like the sunlight is coming from the sun, you can say the sunlight is impersonal. In this room now, sunlight may come in a few moments. So that we say the sunlight is in the room, we don't say the sun is in the room. There's a difference between the sunlight and the sun. So light is impersonal, but the light is also coming from someplace. So Krishna says that light is coming from me. I am the basis for that light also. So the impersonal is also one aspect of the Lord. But the supreme aspect is called Sagun, with qualities, but with spiritual qualities. In this material world, we see the temporary nature of things. We get frustrated by the varieties, by the colors, and we think that if we have no quality, then we'll have peace. You see, but we don't know that there's another higher type of quality which is in itself peaceful, beautiful, and it doesn't go through these changes. So it's saying that actually this material world is a kind of a shadow or reflection of the spiritual world. Just like if you take a movie camera, you have here the light going through the film, so that image is projected, right? It goes to the lens. There is a point where there's a focal point, where that actually the picture is upside down, and then it goes to that point, and then it comes the right side up on the screen. So it says that the impersonal light, that is just like the focal point. And what's on the screen is the opposite of what's on the origin. So what the product, the material product, is the two-dimensional. But the original image was a picture of a three-dimensional object that's been recorded on film and that's now being projected as a two-dimensional. But the origin in this world is three-dimensional, but the original world is fourth-dimensional. And the impersonal light is just a focal point between the two. This is a reflection. This world is a reflection of the original spiritual world. That is where we belong. That is what we're hankering for. Because we don't find that here, we get frustrated. And if we use our own mental speculation, we think, okay, the impersonal light, this will give us peace. But what we really want is that spiritual world, the spiritual environment. Yes?
So the three-dimensional we can define as length and breadth and height.
It's above time. Here everything is under the control of time. So everything has past, present and future. But the fourth dimension is time is also one of the elements which is under the control. It's eternally present. There's no past, there's no future. Here there's no present in the real sense. It's always what, just like I'm seeing you, I'm not actually seeing, I'm seeing a reflection of light coming off your body, coming to my eye, going through my brain, and then it comes down to the Atma who's actually getting the vision. So some time has gone by. Sound is slower than light, so if someone's a distance, sometimes you yell, you know, or you see the jet moving, you can see the jet here, but the sound is coming from behind. So because sound is going very much slower, but light is very fast, so we think it's like immediate. But some time has already gone by. So actually we're never in that complete direct contact. In the spiritual, there's like there's no separation. If you see someone, you're on real time. And you're not seeing a reflection, you're actually, we cannot understand how this is, but you're directly in communication with that person. By seeing, by talking, there's no separation like that. So, I mean, it's obviously our brain is a three-dimensional product. We cannot fully comprehend how it works. But everything is conscious and there's no separation. Everything is, time is not a factor there. Time is under the control of that. So that time factor is what makes a difference in the fourth dimension.